Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to That's Life with Mark Snyder right here on 1410 AM WMSX Brockton, also at PMPnetwork.com for all you internet freaks out there. Hey, what a show today. We have one of the greats of music with us today, a man who is sometimes behind the scenes. Maybe you don't know him a little bit. You will after today's show. His name is Nile Rodgers, and you just heard a little bit of some of the things he's done. La Freak, all the chic music him and his partner have put together, Bernard Edwards. Also, some of the things that you might have heard that he's been responsible for. How about We Are Family by Sister Sledge? Yeah, or Diana Ross, I'm Coming Out and Upside Down. Or David Bowie's Let's Dance. It's on and on and on and on with an incredible career that continues and grows every day. With us right now on the entertainment line is Nile Rodgers. Hi, Nile.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I'm wonderful, Mark.
It's nice to talk to you.
And you, bro.
You have brought so much great pleasure to people and had me dancing personally. You know? How can you not dance with that kind of music?
Thank you. I hear you. You know what? Believe it or not, after all these years, I still respond the same way.
I understand that the first song you ever learned, tell me if I'm wrong, was A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
A Day in the Life, absolutely.
Yeah. That's actually a pretty complicated tune.
Yeah, well, not just to play the, I read the news today, oh boy. That whole part is relatively easy. But what happened was, the thing that makes this an interesting story is that I actually had the fingering figured out, but I didn't know how to tune the guitar.
Ah.
And my stepfather came in and said, and that's not how you tune a guitar. Once he tuned the guitar, I actually could play the song.
So if Graham Benskin didn't do that, what would have happened?
Well, God only knows. I would have been a very avant-garde, strange man.
Now, you actually, according to your bio, you had quite an eclectic mix in childhood of influences in music, from Jewish folk music to doo-wop.
Yeah, right.
Tell us a little bit about growing up, where you grew up, and some of those influences.
Well, I'm from New York City. I'm from Lower Manhattan. And traditionally, that area, the Lower East Side and Greenwich Village, I guess around the turn of the century, was a real melting pot. So you have very, very diverse communities, and they're also, in those days, people loved live music and live bands. So if you considered yourself a professional musician, you had to play for all those communities. You know, I traditionally, easily in the course of 2 or 3 weeks, could play a gypsy wedding, a bar mitzvah, an R&B club on the Chitlin circuit, all sorts of stuff.
Mm. But now, were you actually playing Jewish folk music at any point?
Oh, totally.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
So you know how to do it?
I made a record, Lacha Dodi.
Did you really?
Absolutely.
Did it have a Nagila on it?
No, it didn't have Hava Nagila.
That's kind of required.
Some more eclectic stuff. It was not that commercial.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge seller, huh? Didn't make the big list.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, you moved to the South Bronx, though.
Yes.
And that gave you some more musical influences.
Well, when I moved to the South Bronx, that's when I met Bernard Edwards.
Uh-huh.
We used to work in what we call pickup bands. And a pickup band basically were different musicians that somehow would come together over that one particular event. And, you know, you'd before the show started, you'd all go in the back room and figure out which songs you knew in common. And whichever songs the majority of the members knew, that's what you did, whether you knew it or not. You have to learn it on the spot.
Yeah, Niall, it's interesting because I was in a number of pickup bands as well.
Right.
And most of them were formed just to pick up women. That's why we call them pickup bands.
Oh, really? No, we call them pickup bands because we picked up the musicians. But, hey, I hear you. Every now and then we got lucky enough to pick up girls, too. But mainly we were doing it because that was really our source of livelihood and our income. I've been a professional musician since I was a teenager.
And that was really... When did you actually begin to make money from this as a career?
I really almost right away. I started out very, very young, and I was, you know, I used to do protest music in the 60s, so I'd walk around the streets singing, you know, folk songs, singing, you know, Phil Oaks music and Pat Sky music, you know, singing The War Is Over and Pete Seeger stuff, and that was cool, you know, and just have your guitar case open and collected money. It was a little bit more dignified than just straight-up panhandling. And then... right after that, I used to work at the practice rooms up in Manhattan School of Music. You know, we just go up there and see, because in the 60s were so political that even the schools were political. You know what I mean? Because you basically could just do what you wanted to do in those days. So we would go liberate the practice rooms at various musical colleges. And so I was at Manhattan School of Music, and the people from Sesame Street, they came and they auditioned people from Manhattan, and basically the band wound up becoming all Manhattan School of Music students.
So I understand you were really tight with Big Bird.
Very tight. Big Bird, but mainly Oscar was my man. Oscar and the Count. I love the Count.
You know, here I am. I'm interviewing Niall Rodgers right now on the That's Life show, and I was reading the New York Post, I think it was last week.
Right.
And there's a little thing about you in there. It said that you were actually a member of the Black Panthers. You were a militant.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was the subsection leader of the Lower Manhattan branch of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party was an organization that was sort of set up like almost like a military cell system. You would have a branch. The basic system was called the 10-10-10 system. Each state would have 10 branches. Each branch would have 10 sections. Each section would have 10 subsections. So I was the leader of one of the subsections in Lower Manhattan.
I mean, I remember Eldridge Cleaver's book. We read that in college.
Soul on Ice, right. Yeah. That was required reading in the 60s.
Yes,
Soul
it
on
was.
Ice, Seize the Time.
That was required reading in the class I took in college. And Bobby Seale, of course, it got a lot of attention. And do you think that some of the things that you folks were looking to do at that time have been done?
The thing that's actually quite sad to me is that, you know, in the 60s, we were very, very idealistic. Our goals were clear. They were not only short-term goals, but we had very great long-term goals. And in fact, a lot of the idealism is gone. When I talk to kids now, they're not very future-oriented. They're really very now, now, now. You know, instant gratification mode. And that was the antithesis of what the Black Panthers were like. We believed in discipline. In other words, we could do something today knowing that we wouldn't get the payoff for another 10 or 20 years. Now, the problem with that is that our idealism, in the midst of doing the things the way we did them, there were a lot of problems. So what wound up happening is that none of the stuff really worked the way that we believed and the way that we hoped it would work. So I would have to say no. But, you know, we're in a different age now. We're in a different society. And, you know, how many 17- or 18-year-old kids are worried about being drafted and going off to fight a war? Not very many.
Yeah.
So we've lost that unifying, thread that sort of tied us all together, you know what I mean? Because in the 60s, so many people were afraid to go to Vietnam that you'd get tons and tons of unity with different organizations. And the positive byproduct of that was that you'd also have tons and tons of unity in society. Therefore, you'd have great collaborations. You know, you had the right political time to have a person like a Jimi Hendrix.
Back in those days, did you ever envision the kind of success you'd have in this country?
Sure I did.
You did.
Because I was incredibly optimistic. I really thought that we were the kind of people that would effect change. I really believed that we were the future. I really believed that by the time I was 40 years old, no one would ever even think about the fact that I was black or whatever. I really thought that there would be equality for women and gay people. I think that I really believe that a person might just say something the same way you would say to a person, "Hey, I really like those shoes," or, "Oh, no kidding, look at that, that guy's got a Corvette." I thought it would all be like that, that it would just be not a big deal. It would just be, "Oh, right, okay, yeah, so what?" But I didn't think that after all this time, it would still be the way that it is. I didn't think that after all this time, I'd still hear the same stuff and police shot this one, and yeah, this woman can't get that one, and sexual harassment. I mean, I never believed that it would all still feel the same, and on some level, would almost feel like it was worse. You know what I mean? When I went to school, we were very, very... the academic requirements were very serious. I mean, you know, we worked hard at school, and I'm not dissing anybody. I don't know how people work in school now, but I just know that the practical applications that I see, like when I just talk to a person who's a college student now and we're just chatting, I'm almost saying to myself, "Jesus Christ, what school did this guy go to?" I'm like, man, you better ask for your money back. Because it's just amazing that people don't have the same awareness. You know, very few of the students that I talk to, would they even care to engage in an in-depth, let alone, I mean, they wouldn't even, engage in a superficial political discussion, but they don't even talk about other people and other cultures. It's all very sort of America-centric, if you will.
Talking with Nile Rodgers, we're going to take a break now. Can you hang in here for a while?
Sure, man.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Chic, forming that thing. I mean, for folks out there who remember the La Freak song, which we played earlier, that hit number one in the U.S. and became Warner Brothers' all-time biggest-selling single. And that was just the beginning of many, many different great things for Nile Rodgers and his partner. We're going to talk with Nile when we come back from this break and hear more of his music right after this.
Here at Icon Office Solutions, we're telling businesses how much time they can save with digital technology. Hello, John.
Speaking.
Now, John, I hear that you spend a lot of time waiting to make copies.
Unfortunate, but true.
John, that's an interesting career path. What, did you take courses for this in college, like Standing Around 101?
That's funny.
You know, John, if waiting for the copier ever loses its glamour, you could always get a digital copier from Icon Office Solutions.
Digital? That sounds impressive.
Oh, it is, John. Digital copiers can be connected to your network, so you can crank out multiple originals, collate, staple, and fax right from your desk. These babies can even scan.
You mean I'll never have to stand around the copier again? That's great.
That's right. Just think how much more you can accomplish in a day.
The mind reels.
Let the leader in digital technology show you how Canon digital copiers and printers can help you compete better. Call 1-888-ICON-888. Work to win with Icon and Canon.
You're listening to New England's only daily entertainment talk show. That's Life with Mark Snyder on 1410 WMSX.
If you love music, TV, and the movies, you'll love PMPNetwork.com. That's right, PMPNetwork.com, the Internet's entertainment superstation, has downloadable interviews with your favorite celebrities, great photos to download, and reviews of movies, plays, music, and all the TV gossip you need. It's all in one place, PMPNetwork.com. Check it out on the Internet next time you're surfing the superhighway.
Hey, this is Bad Jack. and you listen to Mark Snyder on That's Life on WMSX.
Listening carefully there, you actually heard live on the air Nile Rodgers doing a little background singing. Welcome back, Nile.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome back.
Hey, I'm trying to get you off the headset.
Ah. You're trying to get me off the headset?
Yeah, I've got you on hands-free for some reason.
I don't know why, but it sounds okay, so as long as you can hear.
Cool. If it sounds all right, no problem.
It sounds fine. So as long as you can hear me, we're all set.
Great.
When you guys got together and formed Chic, Dance, Dance, Dance took off as the first single. Did you ever think it was going to be such a huge success? It really it was an incredibly successful album.
Well, we knew it was going to be huge because, see, we were playing it in the clubs well before we got the record deal.
Ah.
And in those days, people responded in the clubs. That's how you knew something was happening.
Yeah, I actually was at that point in my life a club DJ. Had a place called Uncle Sam's here in Boston, and we got that. I remember the big they had the big singles, you know, the big album-sized singles.
Right.
And that came in on there and was one of the, you know, back then the Tramps and the Funkadelics and the Parliaments and all that stuff were big. And she came in, and boy, that stuff, as soon as you put it on the turntable, everybody get up and start dancing to it, so it was obvious it was going to be a hit.
Well, the thing that was interesting about all of that is that, it was just the beginning. See, we were the producers, and we were starting to experiment with subsonic frequencies. And in those days, because you had to worry about records and grooves and how deep you would cut the groove, you'd roll off subsonic frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
But with the advent of the 12-inch, we realized that we could put, louder and bassier music on it because it was just one song on a side.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, it just took us into a whole new sonic area.
Mm.
And when we released our first Chic record, we knew it was going to be a 12-inch. We made it to be a 12-inch.
Yeah.
That's why on the album, we would only have, seven or eight songs.
What did that first one sell? How many copies?
Oh, it was huge, and the thing that's really sad about it is that we were only accounted to for less than half of the sales, because the original, it came out on two labels. One label was on Atlantic, one release was Atlantic, and the other release was Buddha.
Uh-huh.
Buddha never accounted to us for their sales, and Buddha actually had the better sounding product. Theirs was actually made from the real two-track master. Atlantic's record was made from a copy of the master.
How did it end up on two different labels?
Because originally we were signing to Buddha, but we found out through one of the executive VPs at Buddha that the label was bankrupt.
Ah.
And they actually couldn't afford to press any records, and they had no credit. So the record couldn't come out. So one of the senior VPs decided that here was the opportunity of his life, and he left the label and took us with him to Atlantic.
That's interesting. I mean, because if you think about the kind of music you had, the Buddha label, I'm thinking back 1910 Fruit Gun Company, Ohio Express, stuff like that. Atlantic, of course, had Aretha Franklin and some of these, the Rascals and stuff like that. So it seemed like it was a better fit anyway.
It would have been a great, artistically and image-wise, it would have been great for us to be on Buddha because, they had like records like Andrea True Connection, More, 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 How Do You Like It, and all those disco kind of records.
Mm.
But in fact, it was the right move to be with Atlantic because Atlantic started a whole new dance music department to just handle Chic. So we were a real big fish in a small pond there.
And that, of course, was a division of Warner Brothers, right?
Yes.
Warner Electra Atlanta was they're all together. Yeah.
We are.
So now you also released a couple of CDs after that, a couple of albums after that with Chic, and one of them, of course, had the one in 79 had Want Your Love and Good Times, and it kept going. But how did you end up over with Sister Sledge and the We Are Family thing?
Well, what happened was the president of Atlantic Records, who's the person who actually signed us, a guy by the name of Jerry Greenberg, who runs Michael Jackson's label now, he thought that Bernard and I really had talent. And he offered us the entire Atlantic Records roster. And he says that we could produce anyone on the label. And this was a bold move for that those days, because it was, you know, either real R&B acts or big rock acts, the Stones, Bette Midler, Yes, groups like that, you know, Led Zeppelin, just to name a few. So we really had to do some serious soul searching. And the artists that they wanted us to produce were either the Stones or Bette Midler.
Mm-hmm.
And that was incredible to us because we'd only had one record.
Yeah.
But we decided that if we produced the Stones or Bette Midler, they were such big stars that if those records did well, people wouldn't necessarily think that they did well because of the producers. Right? Because,
right.
You know, maybe with Bette Midler a little more because we probably would have written her songs, but certainly we wouldn't have written the Rolling Stones.
No.
You can hear we're in New York City, huh?
I guess so. Just like I pictured it. Skyscrapers and everything.
So, it sounds like the beginning of a thousand disco records.
I'm just thinking of actually
she made a heavy decision, and we said to the owner of the company or to the president of the company, we said, you know, we believe in our talent so much, instead of giving us an artist that sold a lot, give us an artist that sold very little.
Mm-hmm.
That's who we want. As a matter of fact, we said, give us the artist that sold the least.
Yeah.
And
that was Sister Sledge?
Right. And they said, well, we have these girls that are like family to us. And we were writing this all down. We tried to pretend like we were business people.
Uh-huh.
And we were writing it all down. He says, yes, we have these artists. They're like family to us. They're a group of sisters. And he says, really, they're just like family. And we're going, yeah. And he said, they're called Sister Sledge and this and that. And when you meet these girls, I mean, they do everything together. They hang out together. They go here. And all we did was basically transcribe this interview.
Into We Are Family.
Into the company, into the lyrics of We Are Family.
Which they, of course, immediately liked because it flew back in their face everything they told you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And of course, that was a very catchy tune.
Yes,
as
very catchy.
Yeah, all your tunes are like that. I mean, they all have great hooks to them.
We come from that era. We're hook-oriented guys. You know, we knew that our records would be on AM radio, as we used to call it in those days, and you only had a few seconds to get your point across, and people had to like it the first time they heard it.
That's true, yeah. You know, and again, the more they hear it, you want them to have it liking more and more and more.
That's where the great musicianship comes in.
Mm.
That the more a person starts to discern and then take apart the record to decipher what's going on there, they start to realize, like, wow, this is a great band. These guys can really play. You got to remember that in the 70s, we didn't have things like sampling. So even if I copied an Ohio player's groove, it sounded different because it was all different people playing it.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm looking at this thing here. You took this group that was selling nothing and made them huge, and now, in the eyes of all the folks in Atlantic, you guys must have been living gods walking on their parking lot.
That was the problem in a strange way. The negative byproduct of that kind of superstardom is that we were young upstarts who came from outside the system and gave them their biggest selling stuff. And at a time where the politics of Atlantic, the foundation of the company was built on, you know, classic R&B, but the politics of the label changed very drastically with the, you know, the addition of the Rolling Stones and Yes and Led Zeppelin and artists like that. I mean, it really became a rock label.
Yeah, you know, it really did. But I want to also know about Diana Ross. Talk about that a little bit.
Diana Ross was the first big superstar that we ever wrote and produced for. Diana Ross came to see Chic performing live in Los Angeles one day. And she just says, wow, I just love what they do. It's so cute and so clever and so whatever. And we met her backstage. And once again, we sat down and we had an interview with Diana Ross. And basically, the lyrics for her album are transcriptions of our interviews with her.
And she said to you, I'm really upside down in my career, and I want to come out with a new one. And you said, ha!
You got it. We're making fun of it, but that's basically how it happened. Diana Ross said that she's coming out of her shell. She wants to live in a new place because she was living, you know, on the West Coast and doing the whole Motown thing. She was saying that it was time for her to break out of her shell. She was going to move to New York. She wasn't married. She's doing something new and blah, blah, blah. And then we wrote, there's a new me coming out. I just want to live. And, you know, I'm completely positive. And that's how she felt. It was like she was leaving Motown, but she's going on to a new life.
Wow. And that was a really new sound for her, too.
Yes, it was. And it was a new sound for us because having an artist with the stature of a Diana Ross allowed us to be more progressive. You know, there are no rhythm tracks that we had done prior to that sounded like I'm Coming Out. I mean, that's some pretty avant-garde stuff for Chic, which was old, you know, four in the floor, you know, dance R&B kind of stuff like boom, 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 that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm Coming Out had heavy syncopation and, you know, and even the song Upside Down, which became our first single with her, had that incredibly angular modulation for the verses. I mean, that was very avant-garde for Chic.
And something completely new for Diana Ross, and it worked. Now Rogers is with us. Now, could you hang in there for a little while longer?
Sure.
I enjoy talking to you. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about Madonna and David Bowie and some of your other work, okay?
Absolutely.
We'll be back with more with Niall right after this.
Transport your car great distances. You might be moving, going to college, or even have a prolonged work assignment in a faraway state, or you might be going to Florida. No matter what your reason, American Auto Transporters can help. For 20 years, American Auto Transporters has used tractor trailers and professional drivers to move cars around the country, and there's good reason for using American Auto Transporters. Safety, reliability, and convenience. Simply specify when and where your car needs to be at a particular time, and American Auto Transporters will have it there waiting for you. American Auto Transporters handles all types of vehicles, from domestic family cars to world-class exotics. To find out more, visit the American Auto Transporters webpage at www.shipcar.com or call 1-800-800-2580. Move your car without ever getting behind the wheel. American Auto Transporters, 1-800-800-2580.
Stay tuned for more celebrity interviews coming up on That's Life with Mark Snyder.
The island kingdom shines.
It's a cool world.
Cool world.
Swimming
pool world.
Cool world.
Come
on, play. Catch the rays. Lips and slide and
drift away.
Cool world.
At Riverside right now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's It's your last chance to check out Riverside's free Island Kingdom Water Park. Now 50% bigger with the new Hurricane Bay Wave River and Shark Attack High Speed Water Slide. Hurry in before summer's gone.
It's a cool world.
Cool world.
A sunshine roof world.
Cool world.
Whistling from the sky, up the lazy river, floating by, it's a cool world,
the Island Kingdom shines.
Save $10 on a regular Riverside admission when you bring in any Pepsi product can through September 19th.
Hey, are you hungry? If you are, listen very carefully, especially if you're in the mood for Chinese food. Are you in the mood for Chinese food cooked in vegetable oil, like canola oil, low fat? I know, you don't like MSG. How about some Chinese food that has no MSG? And how about if you can actually watch the chefs cook your food, and knowing that it's going to be in a nice, clean kitchen? Well, you have some choices to make. You can choose, let me see, Chinatown in Stoughton or Chinatown in Brockton. Both places have great luncheon specials and evening specials that you can actually get all day long. That's right. They're not just evening specials. They're all day long specials, and they start at only $5.95. If you want great Chinese food, a nice, enjoyable place to eat, and good prices, well, Chinatown's the place to go. Chinatown in Stoughton at Cobb's Corner and Chinatown in Brockton behind Frank's with a brand new dining room. It's all at Chinatown. If you love Chinese food, you will love Chinatown. For to-go orders, all you have to do is call Brockton 508-580-2885. That's 580-2885 for the best Chinese food to take home.
When you're in Boston, what radio show do you listen to, Phyllis Diller?
When I'm in Boston, I always listen to That's Life with Mark Snyder. Hee hee, I love him.
Talking to you.
Okay, we're going to start.
Sure.
How is it to be in this JG Superbus?
Well, the main thing for me is that...
And welcome back to That's Live with Mark Snyder.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
All right.
We're talking with, of course, Nile Rodgers. You know him from so many different things. We've already talked about Chic and the great experience he had with Sister Sledge and Diana Ross. And, you know, it's interesting. We were just talking here at the station about David Bowie. I have every David Bowie album that ever came out. And his career just kept changing and changing and changing. And when he met you, boy, oh boy, did that career change. That's when that Let's Dance came out, China Girl, Modern Love, a whole new sound for David Bowie. He actually joined the sound that was current and became huge there. How did you end up meeting him and getting him into this whole thing?
I was out with Billy Idol one night at an after-hours club, and we happened to notice that David Bowie was sitting there in the corner. So I went over and introduced myself, and we just started chatting, and we hit it off just right from the word go. Interesting thing is that most English artists traditionally know a lot about music, especially a lot about American music. They're always fans of R&B, and David was no exception, so he and I got along great.
So he knew all your work already?
Oh, yeah. Not only all my work, but you know, others that we both enjoyed mutually.
Yeah, and so he said to you, Nile, can you set me up with that kind of music you do?
Yeah, it was. It's almost that simple. He came over to my apartment and he listened to an album that I had just finished, a solo record, my first solo record after Sheet. And he says, "Man," and his exact words were something like, "Man, if you do a record for me half as cool as that, I'll be really thrilled."
Hmm. So he must have been very thrilled when that came out.
Yeah, no kidding, because I thought his record was a lot better than mine.
Well, it sold better, that's for sure. That was one of his biggest selling records ever, wasn't it?
It is his biggest selling record ever.
That's amazing. And the thing is that a lot of artists at that time changed their sound to sound like the sound you were creating.
Right. Well, the thing is that what we were doing is we were a real rhythm section-based groove unit. I mean, all of our songs came from the bass and guitar. That's how we started writing. And then we'd add the drums and then the keyboards and then write the song.
Hmm.
So we knew what our grooves were going to be like. The great thing about David Bowie is that he came to me with the songs written already. So all I had to do was groove them, if you wish.
Right.
Sort of retool them. It was almost like David had built the house, and he called me up as the decorator.
Ah. What about Madonna? And
Madonna was a similar kind of situation in that she had already had a first album that at the time I met her had been out almost a year.
It did pretty well, too.
And I loved her first record. Yeah. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, it was good.
But the thing is that I knew that there was a reason why, or at least I had a feeling that there was a reason why that it hadn't caught on in the commercial, artistic way that I believe that it should have, based on who she was as an artist and based on her songs and where she was coming from vibe-wise. And I convinced her that that her sound needed to be live. And in those days, there were two camps forming. There was the live music camp and the electronic music camp, the sort of sequence camp. And I said, you know, your first album is all sequence because it's, you know, dance music. And I said, but I know musicians that are good enough to play those exact same songs live. And I said, and I bet you it'll give it a different artistic interpretation. Because a musician, even though they're grooving on the same groove, they're still going to reinterpret it and feel it differently over the course of a linear performance.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I'm not sure if she understood, but she believed in me enough to take the chance. And as soon as we finished the record, I think she could hear the difference right away.
Well, I mean, most people could, and Like a Virgin in the United States alone sold like 7 million copies.
It was ridiculously huge.
It was huge. And that really propelled her.
It sold upwards of 25 million records around the world.
Yeah, I mean, that propelled her into superstardom, that album.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hate to bring up money, but I mean, it must be pretty good for you when you write these songs, especially. And I don't know about producing, but writing the songs that when they get played over and over again. One of our folks over here was mentioning that We Are Family is played at almost every wedding. Do you make money every time that thing's played?
Oh, sure. I mean, you're supposed to.
Theoretically, right?
The tracking and accounting system that deals with stuff like that is pretty good, but it's not perfect. But I make a pretty great living from my songwriting.
That's kind of nice. I mean, I'm sure when you were young and you wanted to do things like this, it's nice to be able to do something you really enjoy and get paid for it well.
It's a dream come true as far as I'm concerned. I've always been a very, very hard worker and an overachiever, if you will. And to have worked that hard and you come up with something that other people like as well. I mean, to this day, I still hear from people who even work at the CD manufacturing plant that'll tell me that things like Let's Dance is still one of the best-sounding CDs ever made.
Hmm.
And stuff like that. And it's really interesting for me because given the limitations of our technical equipment at the time, for people to say that kind of thing to me blows me away.
Well, I mean, you know, you've touched, most people you've touched have turned to gold. I remember Duran Duran's The Reflex. That thing was number one for like 2, 3 months, 4 months.
Yeah, and the funny thing about a song like The Reflex was that, think about this, that was the third single off of an album that basically the record company figured was over. And it was the kind of song that I redid. Almost. In other words, like, I didn't consider myself doing remixes. I said, look, this is the way I would have produced it if I was there in the first place. And the record company wanted the group to give them money back because I had changed it so much.
Hmm.
And in fact, that's Duran Duran's biggest selling single ever. So their third single from an album that was already dying wound up becoming their biggest record.
Tell me about this Chic Live at Budokan CD.
This is a new release that I have out now. I have my own record company and my own distribution company. And when I started the label, what I wanted to do was christen it with a product that that means something to me spiritually and artistically. And of course, if I were going to do anything, I wanted my former partner, Bernard Edwards, on it.
Mm-hmm.
Bernard died the last night that we were performing at the Budokan in April in 96.
Wow.
So this recording is the recording of that last performance, of that final performance. It's not like a typical live record where they record a week's worth of stuff and pick the best stuff. We only recorded one night.
Hmm.
This album is that night. It's the last night of Bernard Edwards' life. And it was a great night because I was surrounded with some of the people that I respect and love the most. Slash from Guns N' Roses, he was there with us. But Slash and I had just finished a film project together, and we just wanted to keep playing together. Steve Winwood was there with us, you know, because obviously I did Higher Love with him and mm-hmm. some other stuff, and
yeah.
we'd become good friends. Simon LeBond from Duran Duran was there with us and sang all night on this 3.5-hour show. Sister Sledge was there with us, you know, sort of like our first Chic proteges, if you will.
Sure.
And, of course, my group Chic.
Hmm. What is it like now going on without Bernard Edwards? You must have lost, I mean, you've lost not only a friend and but a collaborator as well.
Yeah, that part's difficult for me because I no longer have anyone I can just call up and get the absolute perfect information with one phone call. Now I have to do it with a series of phone calls and committees and people that I don't necessarily believe in. I don't have the same history that I have with Bernard. But as far as the spiritual existence and relationship is concerned, I feel closer to him than I've ever felt, because the night that he died, I was the only one there with him. And, you know, and when they put when the Japanese government made me his honorable next of kin and things like that, I mean, that really touched my heart, that I could be there to take care of him in death the way he had so taken care of me in life.
Hmm. Now, for folks that are listening at pnpnetwork.com all over the country and in the world, are you doing any touring, and what else is coming out that they can look for in their stores or on the Internet?
Cool. Well, here's the thing, is that I really... you know, I really want people to go check out this record, Chic Live at the Budokan, because it really tells you, you know, the kind of group Chic is, and, you know, and it shows you how live dance music still has a vibe and it works. Obviously, we'll be touring around in the next few months because of, you know, going into the new millennium and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The way I feel about that is ho-hum, but, you know... But, you know, whatever. The gigs will be fun. The occasion I could care less about. I just love playing live. But then I have a new film and a new film soundtrack coming out called Public Enemy. And the film is, it chronicles the lives of four ex-Black Panthers. Bobby Seale, the chairman and co-founder of the Black Panther Party, Kathleen Cleaver, the highest-ranking woman in the Black Panther Party and ex-wife of Eldridge Cleaver. A guy by the name of Jamal Joseph, who was part of the Panther 21, and myself, Nile Rodgers, who was a section leader of Lower Manhattan Panthers. And the film actually debuts at the Venice Film Festival September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, giving it an unprecedented 3 showings because they love the film so much and they want people to really check it out.
That sounds great. And I wanted to ask you one final question before I let you go. And you've worked with people from Mick Jagger to Grace Jones to the B-52s, to Eric Clapton and Madonna and David Bowie and Diana Ross. Is there anybody out there that you...
Butthead.
Huh?
And don't forget Beavis and Butthead.
And Beavis and Butthead, that's true. Is there anybody out there you'd love to work with that you haven't had a chance to?
Right now... I don't think like that. My brain doesn't work like that. I'm working with a new group right now called Strange Folk on Mammoth, and right now they're doing that for me. They feel like the group I've always wanted to produce.
Strange Folk, huh?
Yeah, Strange Folk.
You got a plug-in for them, too, now. Thank you so much for coming on, Nile Rodgers. I really appreciate talking to you, and maybe we'll talk again sometime.
All right, man. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Take care.
Great.
Bye-bye. Nile Rodgers. We'll be back after this.